Welcome to Reigning in the Bulls with Michael Marks. Today's guest is Payal Sampat. She is currently the Mining Program Director of Earthworks. In this Reigning in the Bulls episode, Payal will discuss gold mining, one of the most destructive activities on the planet. She targeted major jewelry companies including Tiffany's, Cartier, and Zales. This groundbreaking campaign was titled No Dirty Gold Campaign.
Payal Sampat, we're going to talk about the No Dirty Gold Campaign, which I consider to be one of the seminal corporate campaigns in the last 20 years. Let's start with what was your role at Earthworks in this campaign?
I was the campaign director for the No Dirty Gold campaign.
And what was the overall problem or the harm that the campaign was trying to address?
So gold mining is one of the most destructive industrial activities on the planet. And it leaves communities with human rights abuses, contaminated drinking water. It is one of the number one toxic emitters of emissions to air, water, and land, as measured even in the United States, where mining is such a tiny fraction of GDP. And one of the biggest concerns was that this was an industry and a product with this unsullied reputation. And one of the things we wanted to convey was that, in fact, gold wasn't really so clean. It wasn't this sparkling symbol of love and affection if it also was associated with and had come at the price of human rights abuses, indigenous rights violations, poisoned water and air and land. And that is really why we, you know, came up with that particular brand name around rebranding this symbol of love and affection as something that had a not so clean reputation.
What company or companies were your initial focus in the campaign and why?
Well, we wanted to send a message to the jewelry industry writ large. And so while we did do a fair amount of strategic research and thinking about, you know, who would be the most likely targets, of course, those were the ones with the biggest reputational value attached to their sales of gold, such as Cartier and Tiffany and others. We also wanted to make sure that this had a broad-reaching impact across the industry. And there was really a disconnect between mining companies, which were out there, you know, out of sight, out of mind, and these jewelry companies on Fifth Avenue and in malls around the world. And so we wanted to make those connections as well. So one of the mining companies that was at the center of our focus was Newmont Mining, one of the largest gold producers on the planet. Because the supply chains were so opaque, we decided to focus on the top 10 or 15 producers of jewelry, gold jewelry, tick them off one by one. So it was a range of companies. It wasn't just one.
And when you started out, so you really talked about the full range of the companies, the campaign, as opposed to like some of them, like a Tiffany or?
Well, it's really interesting. Tiffany, it's a fascinating story because Tiffany, I don't think they actually got wind of the campaign before it was launched, but they wanted to get ahead of this issue. They had seen what had happened with Blood Diamonds, the movie, the campaigns, and that whole process in which this symbol of, you know, love and affection and engagement, etc., was suddenly seen as something that had all these human rights abuses. And they wanted to get ahead of that with gold. And so, amazingly, a few months before we formally launched the campaign, we got a phone call from the CEO of Tiffany & Company saying, "Where do I get my gold from?" Our launch plan was to be outside Tiffany & Company stores and launch the campaign there. We were not prepared for that move. We did target, as I said, the top 10 producers of gold jewelry or sellers of gold jewelry for the initial phases of the campaign. Tiffany was the first out of the gate in terms of taking action.
Did Earthworks prepare a report or get any kind of videotapes or the overall damage and harms associated with the gold mining?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So we released, was I think really important to have a well-documented report outlining some of the key issues associated with gold mining, as well as some of the places where a lot of the harm was taking place on the ground. So we had a report that dealt with the big picture issues, that had case studies. And I should also note that the co-organizers of the campaign were Oxfam America and Earthworks. So they were our partners in the campaign, along with many frontline organizations, communities who were in harm's way, Western Shoshone Defense Project in Nevada. There were groups in Kyrgyzstan and Ghana and Romania, Peru and elsewhere who were part of the campaign. So collectively, we produced this report, web materials, and also had we didn't really create a film. I think at this moment, if we were doing the campaign, you know, 15 years later, we would absolutely have documented it as a film. But it was really important that we had good B-roll, because that's what got us on CNN National News the very first day the campaign launched, which I think was really important.
I would think so. Did you send a letter to the 10 companies, CEOs of the 10 companies, along with the report? And I'm curious how they responded.
We wrote to, I think it was actually more than 10 companies initially. We sent out letters to, you know, probably more like 15 companies, asking for meetings and informing them that this campaign was going to be launched. So we sent it ahead of time, and we also sought their commitment. Basically, we had a demand set, right? We had what we were calling the golden rules. And those were established by the coalition and through lots of strategic discussion leading up to the campaign launch. So there was a lot of, you know, it's like the tip of the iceberg. You launch, but you've been doing all this work ahead of time before the launch to make sure that that's mature and ready. So we did send out letters, we listed the asks, and we invited those CEOs to a meeting. And our very first commitment was made by Tiffany & Company, I think within a month of launching the campaign.
Did any of the other CEOs agree to meet with you all? And I'd be curious which ones.
Eventually. Almost all of them did. Initially, they did not. And one of the, you know, something that is very much dates the campaign that got us our second meeting, first one being with Tiffany's CEO, was that we also did an action alert at the launch of the campaign that did two things. It asked for customers, for consumers, Earthworks members, Oxfam's members, our partners' members, to sign a pledge saying that they were going to join this campaign. So that was one thing. And we, you know, ended up with hundreds of thousands of people over the course of the campaign joining as supporters. And the second thing was for them to, you know, basically hit send on a on an action alert. And our first target was Cartier. At the time, we had a choice between, you know, send an email or send a fax. And sending a fax, which you wouldn't do now, was something that cost money for us as campaigners, because I think each fax cost, I don't know what amount of money through the Action Network. But we thought, let's try that. And it turns out that the fax number we used is the fax number the Cartier headquarters store, there's their signature flagship store in New York on Fifth Avenue, used to receive all their orders. And the fax machine was tied up for days. And that is what led the CEO to reach out to us and say, let's talk. And when we went to New York and met with him, he brought with him to the table these stacks of faxes that had arrived and blocked their fax machines. Now, it wouldn't be that effective today. You know, perhaps sending a lot of hard copy letters to a mail order or something like that would have that impact. But that's what got our second meeting. You know, there are really interesting stories as to what got some of the subsequent meetings. This was 2005. We caught the attention of the New York Times, that ended up doing a four-part above the fold front page series of stories on gold mining. And the first one mentioned that we had been writing to Cartier and Zales. Zales was another company. The former governor of Texas, Ann Richards, picked up her New York Times and looked at it. She died in 2006, so this was like within a year of her death, saw this and was friends with the CEO of Zales, which is a Texas-based company, picked up the phone and said, are you guys on top of this? How are you responding? And Zales was like, well, we don't know if we got, you know, maybe we got a letter. And so we then heard from the CEO of Zales. And that was the story they told us. So it was really, you know, fascinating that it was a combination of actions from us, as well as getting the attention of some very high profile journalists who wrote stories, went into some very in-depth reporting that also really gave the campaign legs.
So it sounds like at least one of the tracks in the campaign was the real media generation track.
That's right.
The track was really the activist, generating activist petitions, mm-hmm. or the faxes in this case, which sounded incredibly effective. And I do remember those days. And I'm curious, were there other tracks in the campaign? For example, sometimes there's shareholder tracks, sometimes there's legislative tracks. Any others that you exercised?
Well, a few. I mean, on the activist side, there were also direct actions. There were also some very visually arresting direct actions on Fifth Avenue. Again, before we heard from some of these companies, we had this 25-foot-tall moving puppet called Goldzilla, who visited each of these stores on Valentine's Day. I think that was another key thing, was the campaign launched on Valentine's Day. Subsequently, we would use these major jewelry buying days. We had Mother's Day, we had wedding season, Christmas holidays or December holidays. And we'd sort of use those opportunities where there'd be lots of fluffy stories written about, like, what to buy your Valentine, what to buy your mom. We'd use that as a way to place these stories. So there was definitely, you know, the media and the activist track. There was also the student on campus actions. The next phase, once we started to get in meetings with and sign-ons from some of the major jewelry companies, another phase was the students at a number of universities around the country. Much like the sort of sweatshop campaigns, really took on the companies that sell class rings and the like to campuses, Herf Jones and some of these others. And so there were actually on-campus chapters. And was not something that we planned for. It grew organically once a number of college students wanted to know how they could get involved. And I think it ended up with a number of different chapters. In terms of shareholder activism, yes. And I think that also connected to some of the New York Times coverage, because the Times actually followed us at, we went to the AGM of the largest gold mining company in the world, Newmont, that held its AGM at a very prominent Brown Palace Hotel, I think it was called, in Denver. And it was their kind of, it was the party. They would invite all their friends. They didn't expect that, in fact, there would be activists from, basically we had frontline community members from five continents harmed by Newmont Gold's operations: Ghana, Indonesia, Peru, Romania, and the Western Shoshone Nation in Nevada, attend and ask a lot of questions and engage with shareholders. And the New York Times was present, and then based, you know, a whole series of articles, as I said, about the Fold front page articles on that particular group of people. So there was definitely a shareholder component. And there were, you know, the other piece of it was thinking about the golden rules and the demand set that we had were very hard to measure and comply with, because there was no third-party verification system out there for mining. And we had to very quickly recognize that what was happening was that the jewelry industry and the mining industry were going to scramble to come up with a corporate PR response. They're trying to tarnish the reputation of gold. We're going to try and save the reputation of gold and do some window dressing. And so one of the enduring results of the campaign has been the creation of a multi-sector, multi-stakeholder governed system of assurance for mining operations, which is the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance, which is going to have 8 audits at mine sites around the world this year. You know, it just kind of shows you the arc of change. It's taken 15 years for that system to be mature and actually be able to measure at the mine site what we were asking for back then at the launch of the No Dirty Gold campaign.
Were there any companies in Newmont might be an example of this, where you really had to engage in some more serious kind of negotiations with them, just to sit down and really talk through the golden rules and how they could meet them, et cetera? And I'm just curious how those went.
Well, Newmont is a mining company, and you know, just as an example of how different corporate campaigns can be successful or less successful, the mining company has barely budged in all these years. The mining company has not been accountable to people on the front lines and to communities as we would have wanted them to be. There have been some remarkable frontline community actions that have resulted in more transparency and accountability to communities. But what was clear is that the downstream markets actors who have more visibility, you know, are the ones that have been the most responsive, and through that have you know, been able to have positive impacts down, you know, down the supply chain. And what we kept coming up against with the downstream purchasers was, we don't know where we get our gold. You know, we buy it from Deutsche Bank. Stuff like that, like basically throwing hands up, like very opaque. We don't know what our supply chains look like. And so one of the challenges was really digging into those discussions and putting the onus back on those companies. It's not our job as activists to tell you what your supply chains look like, but sure, we could work with some journalists to do some exposés if you'd like. But you guys should be tracking your supply chains. That's part of your responsibility, supply chain integrity. You wouldn't catch an Apple or a Tesla telling you that. You know, it's kind of par for the course now. But for the jewelry industry, they've been able to rely on that opaqueness and the lack of transparency as a way of washing their hands off of responsibility. Basically, I think that was one of the most challenging parts. And then digging into the components of the golden rules, you know, almost all of them came back with, you mean this isn't already happening? You know, the golden rules included, don't source from operations that dump mine waste directly into oceans, rivers, or streams. And we actually heard from one company saying, you mean that's where the gold's coming from? So that was really remarkable to us, was they had no idea. I think the campaign was the first time that was actually bridged. The connection between some of these most profitable jewelry companies and the mine sites from which they were obtaining their gold and silver.
So as you helped companies get more in touch with what their supply chain was, did you see where some of the companies were then switching away from certain suppliers? Because we've seen that in other industries where they send a message that, you know, look, we can move to other suppliers that do meet these standards and away from those that don't.
Yes, I think that was one of the early scrambles, was sort of like, how do we do that? Tell us who we should be buying from, right? Mm-hmm. That's the first question you get, is who's good? Which are the good mine sites? And part of what, you know, we were trying to say was that this is a very dirty industry. It's not like we can point you to some phenomenally responsible mine, but that the jewelry industry has the responsibility and is in the driver's seat to actually be driving positive change on the ground at these suppliers. So one of the things we saw was that this campaign had helped to shift, you know, more transparency and a move towards better standards and practices across suppliers. And there wasn't a really easy ready-made solution in which, you know, don't buy from this place, but buy from this place. It actually resulted in positive practices on the ground. And, you know, we still have a really long way to go. But I think this was really the first time that that started to happen. And another thing that has was set into motion was a desire from some of these jewelry companies to look into secondary sources of gold, so recycled gold. And how do they make sure that, you know, none of the gold that they're selling is actually coming from new mining, but from stocks of gold that have already been mined and are being recycled. So there was a spurred interest in recycled gold.
How did your campaign evolve as a result of the lessons learned in these early days of the campaign? Because obviously it continues. I'm aware of, you know, other campaigns that you've been involved with that are in this theme of the No Dirty Gold campaign and taking still that industry. But how has circumstance and just knowledge caused your campaigns to evolve?
You know, there are a few things. I think one of the lessons learned for us was in terms of holding feet to the fire. So we had gotten as far as like, how are we going to get their attention? How are we going to get them to act? You know, how are we going to move the industry as a whole? The few things we did not anticipate was one, how quickly they'd move from sort of individual company action, which was positive. When companies acted alone, it was largely positive. Two, grouping together as a trade association and letting the trade association respond for them. So that was, you know, it's something I've seen play out now across different sectors as we've taken on the automotive sector, electronic sector, etc. That when you can deal with a company, a single individual company, and have a sort of reputational or brand benefit from acting in a positive way, that's far more advantageous to the herd, right? Them acting as a herd, because it is almost always the lowest common denominator that will be moving forward. Another thing that is, you know, really key, a key lesson learned is how do you hold their feet to the fire? So they sign on to the golden rules. What's the implement monitoring, subsequent monitoring? We did some scorecards following on that. But there needs to be kind of a longer arc to thinking about the campaign than just let's get them to sign on to something, because you want to make sure that they're actually making good on those commitments and not just benefiting from the positive press, you know, they've received from having done the right thing and agreed to the No Dirty Gold campaign's asks. So those are two things. And I didn't mention a strategy that we used early on, which is we actually took out a New York Times ad, I think on the Valentine's Day, the second year of the campaign, listing out leaders and laggards, listing out the seven companies. It actually turned out to be a perfect seven companies that had signed on to the golden rules, engaged with the campaign, agreed to do the right thing, and then naming the seven that were in our crosshairs as the next seven targets. And that was really an effective strategy as well. And I know a lot of campaigns have done leader and laggard kind of approaches, but that was very effective at the time.
You know, one of the things we've seen over the years too is that a campaign like this that really is a seminal campaign, it's one of the first to really break into a particular industry and then begin to establish norms for the industry, draws attention to all the other incidences around the world where they're not living up to these standards. And so it's a way not only of building your organization, but it's a way of building the movement. How has it grown as a movement?
It, you know, broke open the potential for consumer-facing campaigns for this sector that, as I said earlier, is so out of sight, out of mind. You know, when you think about like the energy sector, for example, another extractive industry, you do drive up to the pump and make a decision, you know, is it Shell or Exxon or which one of these bad guys am I going to be supporting today? When you buy it, you know, a piece of jewelry, most people have never heard of BHP and Rio Tinto and Newmont or Vale or any of these other companies. Making those connections and putting the onus on the companies that are selling products made of these metals and minerals. This was, you know, along with the Blood Diamonds campaign, one of the first to do that. And also looking at how to rebrand these shiny metals as being problematic through the No Dirty Gold kind of brand is another one. And And we're seeing it now as campaigners are looking at where do electric vehicle batteries get their minerals, and how do you make sure that the EV companies are the ones charged with the responsibility of ensuring responsible mining practices for the cobalt and lithium and nickel that goes into their batteries. So we've seen it happen now with electronics and, you know, the gold and cobalt and coltan that goes into iPhones. So it led to a number of consumer-facing campaigns. And I think 15, 20 years later, we're in a very different place in terms of also having some of those systems in place to provide better oversight at mining operations, largely as a result of what these downstream purchasers of gold and other minerals have asked for.
Are there any last, when you step back from it, any last big lessons learned or advice or thoughts that you have for future activists as they come in to this arena to keep in mind, or, you know, different arenas where they could learn from the experience of the battles in this area, mining?
Sure. I just named a few, one of which is it's great to think about how you kick off, but thinking about sort of what are the mechanisms to ultimately hold these companies accountable so they don't get the good PR for having taken an action or signed a pledge without actually making good on those commitments. So I think that follow through is really important. One of the other pieces of advice I remember getting as we were building the No Dirty Gold campaign was, you know, thinking about allies. Don't wait till you have all your allies together, but start building the bus and see who hops on with you on this sort of work in progress. Even if the wheels are sort of falling off, you want to have some momentum so that you can be drawing some of those other allies into it. A third really key piece of advice, I guess I'd have, or something that we try and put into place with subsequent campaigns of this kind is just how important it is to have frontline communities who are in harm's way, who are facing the impacts of these mining projects, right there at the table, figuring out how to, you know, develop these campaigns and how will they have utility for your life and for your water and your livelihoods on the ground, and making sure that those are campaigns that are being run out of San Francisco and New York and London are accountable to those communities who are facing the greatest harms.
Pyle, thank you so much. It's such a nice opportunity for me to who watched this campaign from afar to be able to talk with you 15 years later and really go into depth on the lessons learned, and to see where, as you point out, the campaign is still evolving and needs to go next. And you're so right about electric vehicles and the mining issues there. We knew this would eventually be a challenge for us. And it's nice to know that there's at least a template, a model that can be used for assessing the appropriateness of those mining operations as well.
That's right. And I think also because of the campaigns that came 15 years ago, as I said, some of these systems are now in place and mature and ready for this moment. You know, as we scale up and make this transition to renewable energy, we actually have the system in place to provide oversight for these new technologies.
Yep.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Pyle. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you for listening to Reining in the Bulls with Michael Marks. To learn more about Earthworks and how they strive to dismantle systems of injustice as it relates to responsibly sourced clean energy, please visit them at earthworks.org. You can also learn more about other groundbreaking campaigns at reiningin.thebulls.org. Thank you for listening to the Reining in the Bulls podcast. Unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited and may not be used without express written permission. CEI, Corporate Ethics International, and Reining in the Bulls, copyright 2024, all rights reserved.